Hello, everyone. I'm Trent Luce. Welcome to another edition of Roll Route, the program where we gather every day at this time. Well, we do it Monday through Friday anyway. And what we do when we gather is continue to address the issues between food production and food consumption. Jay Truitt checking in from Texas, Andrew Henderson from the UK, and for both of his knowledge, the UK or Ireland, neither one are in the top 10 potato producing countries in the world.
Yeah, because we don't grow potatoes. We grow potatoes. Two different things.
Yeah. Well, I come from a part of the world that just says taters.
Taters.
I don't know. No, we're just tater people. Potatoes. We don't even do the whole PO part.
Potatoes.
They're potatoes. Not potatoes. Isn't it spelled with an E-R at the end? Tater.
Potatoes.
Potato. Yeah.
Okay, tater. What's the number one potato producing country in the world?
Oh.
This should be easy, actually.
Well, it'd be the United States, probably.
Yeah. No, and we're not. We're fifth.
What?
Yeah. Mm.
Well, then
who's number one in producing everything?
Sheep. Wait, no, pigs.
China.
Modern world, China. But
yeah.
In modern worlds, if I don't like your answer, I just criticize you from here on out. It's not that.
True
it's
story.
Not that I don't need to be accurate. I just need to be critical of your opinion from here on out.
So that's
my new strategy.
I'm genuinely surprised if China is the number one in potatoes, though, is it?
Double of number two. 94,
number two?
Whatever that billion pounds is. I would have never guessed number two. I doubt you guys will either.
Maybe like Argentina or someplace?
Yeah, no. It's in the Northern Hemisphere.
Okay.
No.
Russia.
No. Actually, I don't know that. I don't even know if I spoke truth there. I think it is. India.
Parts of India might be in the Northern Hemisphere. Parts of it would be in the Southern.
Really?
Oh, wouldn't it? I think. Yeah, I'm sure it is because Southern Ocean Race.
No, I think you're actually wrong there, Jay. I don't think any of India's in the Southern Hemisphere.
The Himalayas are below the line.
Are they?
I don't know. See, now we're all going to have to go out. Now I'm going to challenge all of you.
Now it's turned out to be funny. Okay.
No, now we're gonna get... No, hang on. No, the equator, right?
Right.
If you look at the northern, I don't think India comes anywhere near the southern hemisphere.
I don't think it does either.
The northern hemisphere.
I'm with Andrew. I think it's all in the northern hemisphere.
And it's not just in the northern hemisphere. It's comfortably in the northern hemisphere.
Comfortably. All right, let's go through this list of 10, and then we'll get on something other than taters. Number three is the Ukraine.
Ooh.
Ukraine. That one actually doesn't surprise me as being a big one. I just didn't.
We're fourth, not fifth. USA. And then Russia, then Germany, then Bangladesh, and France.
Bangladesh. And what was number two? India. And number one was China.
Number one's China by 94 million pounds. No, not 94 million tons. And China's second with 54, so almost half of China. And we're at 18, Jay, just so you know. 18 million metric tons.
Oh, really?
Yeah.
I find
okay,
that great.
So I will just say this. And Andrew's correct. And with the exception of some India-influenced islands that potentially are close, but it is well inside the Northern Hemisphere.
You know what? If you're going to try and tell me that there's some Indian empire that has an enclave in the Maui Islands of
No, it's not even.
That's where you're going with this. That is pathetic.
We're more talking about islands that they've been swapping back and forth with the British, that you know that they're the ones that have no value, right? None, not even you can't even do anything with.
Yeah.
So they don't even count.
Hey, I know where there's an island that's close to having no value. It's called the United States of America.
Right, yeah. Well, it kind of depends, right? We could discuss it. It has a lot of debt assessed to it, but it may not have much net value.
I figured something out.
What is the value of U.S. resources versus your $134 trillion debt? Do you know?
No.
Time out. We're at $35 trillion, not $134.
Oh, sorry. Yeah, $35
trillion. No, but well, no, wait, though, right? There's two ways. So if you fill out a financial report, you have current debt, right? Mm-hmm. Future liabilities, typically. Yeah. Mm-hmm. And when you look at our future liabilities, we are right at that $100 trillion mark.
I thought you were.
Andrew may be closer than I am even, because I think that number has been incrementally climbing. But that makes some assumptions, right? And the assumption is that Social Security is going to continue and that current spending.
Those are the assumptions of the same spending level we're currently on. But correct. I want to say, let's just finish your balance sheet, because I figured something out the other day. This was after my little soiree with Tom Bilsack, because I went into this concept. There's nothing wrong with $34 trillion worth of debt. No. If you have $150 trillion worth of assets.
Yeah,
absolutely. That's the point.
But guess what? What's the next step? What did we feel like we just pushed back? The movement for the national asset companies. And so it's pretty easy for me to see that they have figured out that the assets are owned by the very people who actually owe the debt, us, and they're trying to utilize our assets to offset our liability by taking our rights away, our property rights.
Yeah. So here's the more interesting thing that only the government can get away with, right? And that is on their balance sheet for GDP or net value, however they want to calculate it. You know what they do? They claim all of our property.
Yeah.
Right? As their asset.
By the way, I'm going to inject something.
They don't really own jack squat.
I think they also trade our birth certificates. I think that the conspiracy theorists are going to be made right with that. I think they do.
So do you think somewhere out there they're going to say, hey, I've got two Anthony Smiths. I need a Jim Bob Larimore or whoever that
I always wanted to be on a baseball card. Maybe I actually am and didn't know it.
Yeah. Oh, that was your goal at one time in life, right? Was to be on a baseball card.
With that facetious answer, I will reply with a facetious reply. Yeah. Because it makes sense to me that if you then depopulate a country, then the birth certificates that exist become far more advantageous financially. Correct. Because you are the custodians of that country. Yeah. So
that's correct, though.
I can almost see why the fascist, globalist, net zero population extermination plan puts more assets into the individual's hands by reducing the population.
I don't disagree with you, except they don't need to exterminate us to get that to happen.
We can, more importantly, in the United States, we figured out a little game, and that was to create a debt obligation for each one of those people almost from birth. And we make an estimate of it based on what we expect that person, how long we expect that person to live, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. And then we tax the person to pay off that debt, a portion of that debt that we're returning. I mean, Social Security is really designed in a way that the debt exists from the beginning. You think you're paying into your own plan, but the reality is that there's an obligation that's held against you. And then if you die, here's the really sick part of it. If you die fast.
Earlier.
Yeah, if you die early in life, well, then the government wins because they got you to pay
that's what
for
I'm
nothing.
Trying to say. I'm sorry. That's what I'm trying to say. I mean, it makes sense to me that all these young people, if you can increase your debt rate by 10 to 20%, which is actually happening at the moment, Our death rate is 22% above the five-year average. So what they've decided to do is change the way the figures are monitored so that people don't realize what's going on. Then you get exactly what you've just said.
And Andrew, if that were the case, then they would start calling us worthless eaters. Oh, wait. I got something that's not worthless. Deplorable. Yeah, we got to get to this. The most tender beef supply on the planet. I can say that because we verify every single calf possesses two copies of the myostatin gene. That's not true. Every calf has one copy of the myostatin gene. Every parent had two copies of myostatin gene. What's that mean to you? That means that the meat is going to be tender. The reviews are coming in daily now because a lot of people have been trying this. 100% of the beef comes from Great Plains cattlemen. You get more details from the Protein Plethora website. It's called CPBeef.com, short for Certified Piedmontese. You don't have to spell Piedmontese, just CPBeef.com. We're back with the second segment. Roll Route right after this. Welcome back. Roll Route, Trent Lewis, Jay Truitt, Andrew Henderson. It's amazing where you can go when you start talking about taters, but we got there. Jay, I want your take on this because you're closer to the fire. And I saw, and we talked about it on Across the Pond. You might have caught that, but the Roll Route listeners would not have. High path avian influenza in cows. What's up with West Texas is being targeted for everything now, from fire to even avian influenza with cows? What's the latest on this that you're hearing?
Just that they've identified the herds, they've started some testing, they've already started the liquidation process, right? But I don't know that we're anything unique except that we're part of we are in the migratory bird path, right, through that part of the world. It's just one of the unique things. The birds don't typically stop there very much because there's no water, right, in big chunks of that. But we do have a pretty significant dairy influence in what the United States calls West Texas, which I think a lot of us would still call those portions of Texas, or maybe Central Texas, right, that extend the western side of Central Texas. But no,
Fort Worth. For me, that's West Texas.
Yeah, to some people it is, and others would tell you.
And there is no liquidation. There's no liquidation taking place.
Well, no, some of the producers are trying to figure out how to liquidate those animals just because the production has dropped to, abysmally small numbers.
Yeah, 10% of them, they're telling me, actually dry up and do not continue to milk or lactate. But they show symptoms for a week, and they just have like a slight flu and then move on.
Right.
Trent, just to interject, is that also the same with humans? Yes. Are you telling me that?
Well, I don't have any data on lactating humans and high path avian influenza, but that would be an interesting thing to find out if there is some. In the human population, you get symptoms for a week and then it's just like a flu.
Dairy operations in that part of the world though, right? Operate like a Swiss clock, right? And they don't fool around. So when a cow goes out of production, if she's over a certain age, we call her, bam, she's gone. And a heifer is already standing there waiting to come into the system, right? And it'll put a strain on, put a tiny short-term strain on 2 million head or whatever is not a lot of animals. Let's be honest, in that environment, if that's what it ends up impacting in total, they're not going to cull 2 million head, obviously. You're not going to depopulate 2 million head, but you could end up with 20 or 30,000 head of heifers coming back into the system really fast and some cows going out. I doubt you'll even notice a change
the latest development in problematic issues for dairymen, though, is because of sexed semen. And right now, we have so many. I'm told that 60% of the dairy cows in the United States are being bred to beef bulls.
And yeah, I think that's those probably
beef,
right.
And those beef calves are worth today, I'm told, $700, and some have brought $1,000 at birth.
Yeah.
That's insane. But it has put a crimp in the available replacement females. Ironically, for whatever reason, many guys in Wisconsin have had heifer development in Southwest Kansas and in Texas. And so this region of the U.S. has become very important to the entire dairy sector right there in Texas.
Oh, yeah. Yeah, no, I mean, it is, again, I don't want to play that down. I just, again, to the point that I think I was making literally is that the system is in place, but it's designed to feed the current environment.
Yeah.
Right. I mean, it's that's kind of a carefully balanced number, right? People aren't trying to get outside of that. And yeah, but I mean, to your point, we are using semen today from very, very specific lines inside the beef industry that match perfectly with those Holstein or Jersey lines, even in some cases, that produce a much higher feed efficiency animal. I have looked like extensively at that data and how they've been improving that data over time. And say in California, right, as an example, there's some herds that haven't produced a heifer. Other than the freak oddity of nature now, they haven't really produced a heifer on their operation for several years. And so the guys that are doing heifer development have become more of a critical cog in that whole system, that whole wheel.
Andrew, do you have the same development where the dairymen are using beef bulls on dairy cows?
Absolutely. In fact, we are getting encouraged to get involved in beef schemes now through the supermarkets. Aberdeen Angus, some Dutch breeds are being looked at. Some lots of new beef breeds actually are being encouraged into the dairy industry to try and give some variety on the offering of beef in the supermarkets. I actually quite welcome it. I don't like farmers being told what to do. I like them to be given the option.
Yeah.
But I think it's good that we've got these programs coming in because it's like everything else. It gives more choice. And I welcome choice, to be honest.
I mean, more importantly, so sometimes, you know, we're critical of technology and what we can do. But when you can, and this is hard for me to say as a pure beef guy, right? But there is a different, slightly different shape to a dairy influenced ribeye, right? It produces a slightly different shape, and on a plate in a nice restaurant, that shape of ribeye can be preferable. And so, just by the way it sits on the plate, and there can be some additional consistency issues that you get from the dairy influence. And if you combine that with the not just any beef genetics, but beef genetics that actually mesh with those dairy genetics really well, now you're getting an animal that for the first time in its life, you have a dairy influenced animal that's feeding at feed efficiency numbers that approach what a beef animal has been doing in the past. And they're getting this nearly the same kind of gains. And so the cost of production changes dramatically, and therefore the price of that calf now becomes more like a beef calf instead of a dairy calf when he's really young. And topsy-turvy world, right? Whoever thought we'd be here, but guys out in Colorado have like figured this down to the they can tell you when the animal is inseminated pretty much the exact day it's going to be finished.
Mm-hmm.
And how many grams of feed it's going to consume in its life. So
I want to just ask that. Let's have a look at that Colorado example. What do you think the average life of a beef animal, you know, in a standard breed, What is the lifespan of that animal in the USA at the moment?
25 months.
Yeah, are you talking about a cow or a steer?
Fed steer, I think you're talking about.
Fed steer, yeah.
I'm going with 25 months.
I'd say a little bit less, but yeah, somewhere in that category. I'm guessing we're getting it down to maybe below 20 months.
Okay.
You have your calf feds that come out of the come off the cow and go right to the feed yard. The issue is that you have 70% of the U.S. calf crop born in the months of March, April, May, and then they're marketed in 12 months of the year. So you have your calf feds, which would go in 17 months. But when you start adding what's going on with the calves that are in a stocker phase, just to make sure we have the same number of animals delivered 52 weeks a year, I'm going with over 20.
Yeah, there's still a massive disparity in the U.S. You know, between the number of beef animals and the number of dairy animals, but in the dairy model that we were all just talking about, you don't have that disparity of calf birth dates. They have a calf. They're having calves every day of the year, 365 days a year. And so you eliminate that variability in that, and those numbers can come way down.
Hold on, Andrew. Excuse me. You can pick it up right there when we come back with more. I want to remind folks about controlling pests in the field. In this case, we're talking about Apache sprayer technology. And those pests would be weeds and or insects. In fact, you use the Apache sprayers for fertilizer application as well. Simpson Farm Enterprises in Hayes, Kansas continues to lead the way in innovation and service. Get more details about the Simpson plan by going to the website, simpsonfarm.com. And they do business from Nebraska south in the Great Plains of America. If you're interested in going north, High Plains Apache on the web at highplainsapache.com. We're back with the second half of Rural Route after this. Welcome back, Roll Route. Trent Lewis alongside Jay Truitt sitting in a tree by himself. Andrew Henderson, he got cut off. So, Andrew, what were you going to say? We're talking about beef and dairy.
It's interesting because I asked that question about the Colorado, and you two had a discussion about the 20 or 25 months. And we have the same discussion here in the UK because different breeds, different times. But when you look at what's actually happening in Europe, and the Dutch way, the Dutch have developed their beef industry in a way that you would not imagine. Would you believe that their average slaughter rate on their rosé beef or rosé veal, whatever you want to call it, but it's the number one red meat sold in Europe. Do you know what the age of that animal is?
Well, if it's veal, it's totally different than a fed beef animal.
No, I never said it was veal.
You did say rosé veal.
Rosé veal, but it's actually rosé beef because it's fed concentrate. Its feed conversion rates are the most incredible levels. What age do you think they're slaughtering that animal at? Because
how big are they?
They're about 800-900 pounds.
So they're 12 months old.
No, that's the thing. 7.5 to 8 months old. And that's the thing. That is the thing that really, I mean, I've got to know that recently, and I know exactly how they do it, and it's not through feeding milk, believe it or not. It's nothing like that. It's all to do with a really strict ad lib diet that maximizes the growth potential of that animal. Not the fat potential, the growth potential. So I find that this very interesting because I think that when we start to talk about the nonsense that people talk about, you know, how cows emit so-called greenhouse gases and all that, we're going to be pushed this way, frankly, but I'm not sure it's the right way. That's all I'm saying.
Why wouldn't it be the right way? It's a matter of the amount of inputs and what you get out. And I have no doubt that the inputs are lower, even though they're fed a higher rate.
Yeah, you then get issues of taste, texture, you know, the actual product itself. They'll give you some very good reasons why you should be consuming meat that's young. But the one thing that I don't think it'll deliver on is what I tasted in Colorado, that taste. I don't think they can achieve that taste.
And I think that flavor. Yeah. A lot of that, though, is basically that's a ration ingredient, right? I mean, so this is where everybody has their own specific taste preferences, too, right? That you got to accept. But I'm still one of those people. I really like that grass flavored, that slightly more aged animal flavor profile that's had a bigger forage base. If it's been a good forage base inside of its diet, and probably because that's what I was raised eating. Right. So we may have put 30 or 40 pounds of grain through that animal at the very end of its life, but the bulk of its life, it was consuming more forage than grain. And, that does make a difference, and it makes a difference when it's corn silage versus alfalfa silage too, and et cetera, et cetera. All those things matter, and people have a preference for both, right? So it's a little bit of a weird thing. And in one of the things in Europe, I mean, the reason I say that is in Europe, when I lived in the UK, was during the heyday of fish meal feeding, right, and proteins to cattle. And I had a hard time even like eating beef, right? Because that was kind of an off-putting flavor to me. But to the people that had kind of grown accustomed to it, it was their normal, and they didn't notice it. But boy, I did. And the quality was fine, just the flavor was seemed off, right? And if you're, it's a matter of personal preference. I don't know that you can really.
Well, you know, we have this huge trend, and it's just a trend, to grass-fed beef in the U.S.
Uh-huh.
And I don't think it's driven by taste as much as it is ideals. People think that there's something inherently better for Earth if they're eating grass-fed beef. Rather, and I know that's not your reason, Jay, but
no, huh?
Completely irrelevant to the fact that we feed cattle corn, and corn is the kernel of grass.
Right. It's a seed, still. It's
a seed from a grass plant.
Jay,
can you pull your headset away from your mouth a little bit? You're way
off. Oh, yes.
Yeah.
Sorry. No, maybe I was screaming too, though, right?
No, you changed your audio when you changed your.
I did. I had to change devices here. No, the reality is, though, is that we keep trying to find a fix for a problem that we never really found the right target for in the first place in the beef industry. In the pork industry, they did a pretty good job of doing that a couple of times. Once I think was a big mistake, and the other time was to kind of correct that, and it improved a bunch. But in the beef industry, we just can't find the right target in the United States. And so we're trying to shoot for a 4-star, Michelin level restaurant in New York. And we're also trying to produce a product at the same time that a Midwestern lady whose husband works at the 3M plant somewhere, can afford to purchase on occasion. And that's a giant spread. And then you throw on top of that these crazy nuts that really are trying to use external pressures to really eliminate beef production in the United States. That's the reason that all started. And you go, okay, well, you can't keep up. You can't make it work.
But that's a great point, because we constantly cater to what we think the ribeye needs to look like on the plate. And the product that we eat now almost 60% of the time is ground beef. It doesn't matter how big the ribeye was. It doesn't matter the shape. It doesn't matter all of these other things. And back in the day when we were so critical of feeding pure Holstein steers in the system, is that, well, you got to feed them to 1,600 pounds to get to their end point. Now you talk to anybody who's sorting cattle out to go to the packer, and they're, well, yeah, we weighed 1,657 this week. I'm like, good grief, they were ready.
Yeah.
But that's how we're going to continue to get tonnage, is that we're going to make the cattle bigger, because we're not going to build these cow numbers in the short term future.
No, we haven't been for 50 years. Let's be honest. Right. I mean, we keep having this false discussion in the country about what is our actual cow numbers. And that really is irrelevant in terms of what our production capacity is and our production capabilities are. Well, there was a time when we had three times as many cows as we do now, but our calving percentage, our actual live calves at the end of the 9 months, based per cow exposed to a bull, was something like 70% back then. So 30% of them never produced anything that year. And that's not the case today. And so, you know, we're our genetics are different today than what they were 40 years ago, in ways that are unmeasurable, honestly. Yeah. I mean, unrecognizable.
It's still a great business, though, isn't it? Because the opportunity's still there for us to develop these new products and develop these breeds and cross these breeds to delight the general public for years to come. And that's the great thing about the beef and dairy industry, in my opinion, that we have so much opportunity to be diverse. I think that's a good thing.
In 1954, there were 24 million dairy cows in the United States. Today, we have 9 million, just under 9 million dairy cows. But with one third of the dairy cows, we produce three times the total amount of milk. That's the success and the efficiency of what's been accomplished.
Right.
Absolutely. Absolutely.
And again, if you look at the beef numbers, I had somebody send me a chart the other day, and it was showing how our beef cow numbers were the lowest that they've been. And, you know, they keep kind of ticking down and they're the lowest. And I go, okay, but what is our actual beef production number? Well, when you lay that chart on top of that, well, it looks differently.
Yeah,
it still is declining, but not big, nowhere near in the same way. And the gap between the number of animals and the production itself is dramatically different. You're talking about like three times the production today of what we had in that same comparison. And so, come on, right? I mean, sometimes we're trying to, it's like in the United States, and I'm sure they do it in Europe as well. We have this never-ending story that says, hey, we got to do something for young farmers because the average age of farmers is 60. Well, you know what it was in 1940?
Probably 60.
Yeah, it's always been 60. Go through every USDA report and they lament the fact that it's constantly 60. And the reality is it's just not, guys? It takes a long time.
What, Andrew?
No, but it's the farmer doesn't like relinquishing his checkbook. That's the reason for that.
Sure.
I mean, I see a lot of farmers who are the farmer on the name of the business, but they're no longer the farmer on the farm. They're still holding the checkbook though.
Yeah.
I always find that very funny. I think that's a farming phenomenon.
Yeah.
I really do.
Never turn it over to the next generation until they're in their 50s. Well, and so it doesn't bring the average down very much, but they've been farming for their whole life, right? They were born in a tractor cab somewhere on a cold winter's night, you know, and them, their wife, their kids are already farming by the time they take over the farm.
There is something as well. Please take this the right way, because I see myself as not a farmer. I'm supported by the farmer. And what I've noticed over my life is that a farmer can keep acquiring and renting land. The farmer that's got it in his blood will never sell any land. It's really quite remarkable.
I got to go to a break. We got the last segment of Rural Route just ahead. Greg Hager continues to bring his country and Christian roots to keep this nation in boots. He does it through lyrics and song. Get more information about Greg Hager, how you can buy his albums, where he's going to be on tour, or just get him to come and speak or sing to your group. You will not be disappointed. Inspires one and all. We'll be back. GregHager.com, by the way, to find that. We'll be back with the last segment, Rural Route, just ahead. Welcome back. Rural Route, Trent Luce, alongside Andrew Henderson, playing center field, Jay Trout, and right field. Let's shift gears for a moment. Not that I ever want to talk about anything other than a cow, but everybody knows that the Francis Scott Key Bridge was targeted and taken down. Did you also know that in 2020, there was a Francis Scott Key monument in San Francisco that was targeted and taken down and has never been replaced? In fact, it was replaced with monuments to Black individuals. And now the message is that Francis Scott Key, author of the Star Spangled Banner, wrote the white national anthem, and we are going to eliminate him from this earth.
Never, you know what? I'll be honest.
Find a way
with
to divide. That's all it is. Find another way to divide.
I really just stopped paying attention to some of the kooks, and
But the kooks are doing it.
Yeah. No. Yeah.
Well, Go ahead. Are they really? Because at the end of the day, immediately your regime said that it wasn't a terrorist attack, probably because it wasn't, because they did it themselves. Because it's so obvious when you look at that response time to know that that told you everything you needed to know that it was, because they hadn't even looked at the black box. They were on the TV within an hour telling everybody that there was nothing underhand going on here. It was so obvious that there was, that they didn't get away with it. That's the way I see it. And the idea that the president then came on, or whatever he wants to call himself, and said that the public purse will pay for the rebuilding of the bridge without even going into the insurance claim was said everything, because that means that he's going to try and hide any evidence that there might be that shows it was a terrorist attack. It's just so obvious.
But the repercussions to agriculture, Jay, will be felt, because it was a big deal for exporting some agricultural products. It was a big deal for importing fertilizers and components that improve agriculture. And what is going to take a dent in the imported car? And when we talk about imported car, we're talking about bringing those U.S. owned cars that are manufactured somewhere else back into this country. From a port and a living standpoint, it's going to put a crimp on the supply chain.
Yeah, I would say, so I don't really spend too much time thinking about the auto industry, but the parts industry that supports that, right, which does matter. It's a port that matters. If you live in that part of the world, it creates a whole different set of nightmares. People that don't live in a dense population region where everything operates at near capacity all the time, there's 34,000 cars and trucks go across that bridge every day, of which it's one of the smaller bridges, but it still is real. Now you have to add 34,000 to another bridge. The bay is still the bay. You can't drive across it without being on a bridge. And so you have to look for one of the alternatives. And that means that all the infrastructure leading up to that, that's kind of a sidebar to your point though, Trent. I mean, we do have port, we're not underutilized. We are underutilizing some of the port capacity that's in the region. And so maybe this will actually make the Wilmington port really live up to its capacity standard, which it could. And that's a good place. And it's easier to get product away from the shore there and get it to the infrastructure, Highway 95 north and south and Route 1, et cetera, et cetera. But with that said, that doesn't happen overnight. And you don't just you know, you don't just have a place to offload fertilizer, bulk fertilizer, right? And so
during planting season, by the way.
Yeah, right. At the very moment when it's important to keep supplies flowing through the system. And so you see a spike for that.
And 25% of the coal exported goes through that port as well.
Yeah. No,
it's easier to shift all your inputs to another port. But when you have coal there in West Virginia and Kentucky, you can't shift that to Houston very quickly.
Well, and one of the things that does kind of get lost in the conversation is that about half of our U.S. ports only have a limited Panamax size capacity, right? The new Panama size ships are significantly bigger than the old Panama size ships. And so again, the ports like Newark, they're pretty much ready. And they can take some of that capacity. Wilmington has the ability, but doesn't have the experience. New York, you can only put so many Panamax size vessels in that harbor before you're out in the ocean. And then it becomes difficult to kind of line up the offload. And so it's a real deal. And Jacksonville, which is one of the big ones on the East Coast that should be able to pick up the slack and should maybe profit from this as much as anybody, Jacksonville is not on the coal line. Coal doesn't go that way. Mm-hmm. I mean, so now you have to reroute trains all the way from Wyoming back, right, to try to get to Jacksonville, and you have coal cars in places that they shouldn't be, and coal trains where they weren't expected to be, and now they're clogging up the system. Right, you have to do something. You have to move them to put something else in its place, and it's a big chore. That bridge is forever old, but I think I've driven across it lots of times to visit friends that lived on the other side of the bay there, and always seemed like a great deal. But of course those vessels are massive, you know, they can do a lot of damage, and we all saw it live and on video what happens when you slam one of those ships into a pier, right? You can take a bridge out. It doesn't
Andrew,
take much.
You're back.
Yeah, I'd like to say I was taken out there, but it wasn't. My phone got too hot, so I don't know how, but it said it was too hot. But maybe it was the topic. Maybe it was the topic. I mean, look, at the end of the day, why would a country not claim a terrorist attack? That's the first thing. If it wasn't a terrorist attack, and the only answer to that is that you might have inflicted it on yourselves, which, to be honest with you, I believe that that's what's happened here. I can't see any other reason for that bridge. I mean, if you see the speeded up version of it, you know that 2 minutes of the black box data has mysteriously gone AWOL. And then you find out that Mitch McConnell's sister-in-law, who mysteriously died in a Tesla reversing into a lake 6 weeks ago, was the CEO of the company
That's false. She's CEO of a competing company.
No, it was the company that...
No.
I looked into this. She was in your... But they, at that point, that company had control of that ship. It was not a rental, what do you call it? They were working on behalf of that company. So when you look at all of that information, and you look at what's coming out at the moment, you know, the idea that you don't have an insurance claim just says everything you need to know there.
Well, what is for sure is that that family is from China. They're Chows.
Yeah. Well, you know, at the end of the day, then why wouldn't the government admit that it was a terrorist attack?
there's something very nefarious going on there, and it's not good. It's
to protect ourselves from enemies, foreign and domestic.
Yes, exactly. I would say you're on the money there. I don't understand why the American public haven't. Do you think the American public are realizing that, or do they really believe that was an accident? What's your thoughts?
I don't think they. I think 70%+, probably the 80-20 rule, 80% think, oh, that was a terrible wreck, and then what am I going to have for lunch?
Yeah, no, I was gonna take that a little further. I think probably 70% of the public at large, you would have to tell them again what happened.
Yeah, I'm not arguing that at all.
Yeah, I don't think we're just a society distracted by ourselves constantly. So now if you were to say Taylor Swift's skirt got ripped or she fell on stage last night, about 70% of the country would know. For one reason or another.
I was going to say there was a ULC basketball game where one of the sides refused to stand to your national anthem last night at UCL, and apparently that's big news.
Yeah, the LSU women's basketball team walked off the floor for the national anthem.
They did?
Yeah.
I watched the last half of that game, but I didn't see the national anthem.
Iowa's women promptly whipped them. Yeah.
Yeah. So that's good. That was good news for me.
Why would
a basketball team walk off your national anthem? Are they that divided in your country now? Is that true?
At that age and that level. Right, they're it's a college campus, right? They're idiots.
Wow.
And so, wow. That comes back
to the coach. The coach has to be accountable to that. When I was playing high school, my coach made sure when the national anthem was playing, I was standing at attention and gave respect that it was due.
Absolutely. I always thought that it was a. I remember I've been to baseball games, numerous baseball games in the States, and I've seen how passionate people are about their national anthem. So I'm amazed that this is happening.
Yeah.
It backfired on the LSU women, by the way.
It fired Caitlin Clark up, apparently. She had 41 points and 12 assists. So there you go. I was distracted for a moment last night, half of a basketball game.
Yeah.
Don't forget to check out Nitric Oxide. Dr. Nathan Bryant is the foremost authority when it comes to cardiovascular health, and nitric oxide is how I start every single morning. NO2U, NO2U.com. Go get details online, and don't forget, if you decide to order, Trent is your coupon code. For Andrew Henderson, Jay Truitt, I'm Trent Lewis. All three of us reminding you that all roads do lead to a roll route.
Bye, everyone.
You got time for a beef bite? Go to cpbeef.com. It's the most tender beef you can find. It doesn't matter whether it's jerky, ground beef, or the ribeye. cpbeef.com.